A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us a prompt that gets at something genuinely strange when you stop and think about it. He points out that the White House Situation Room is one of those places reporters mention so often it feels almost familiar, even though almost nobody has ever seen it. And that's unusual. There are countless military headquarters and government command rooms around the world, but almost none of them have become household names in quite the same way. So he wants to use that as a jumping-off point. What actually is the Situation Room? Is it literally a single room or a larger complex? What happens there on a normal day versus during a crisis? Why has this particular facility become so iconic? And then he broadens it out. How does it compare with other national command centers? What secure communications and intelligence feeds distinguish it from an ordinary conference room full of screens? Is it primarily a place where decisions get made? Or an information hub that supports leaders while operational commands are issued elsewhere? And then he asks about the UK's COBR, Israel, France, Russia, China. How do other countries organize similar facilities? And finally, how much of what we see in films reflects reality versus Hollywood's version of crisis management?
And the reality is both less cinematic and more interesting.
So let's pull back the curtain and see what's actually behind that door.
First thing to get straight, and this is the single biggest misconception, it's not a single room. The White House Situation Room is a 5,000 plus square foot complex in the West Wing basement. It's a suite of spaces. You've got the main conference room, which is the one everyone's seen in the Bin Laden photo, but there are also smaller breakout rooms, soundproofed phone booths, and a 24/7 watch floor staffed by intelligence and military personnel. It's more like a small office building buried underground than a room.
A basement office park for the end of the world.
Pretty much. And the whole thing is a SIF, a sensitive compartmented information facility. That means everything from the walls to the wiring is designed to block electronic surveillance. No cell phones go in. The windows don't exist. The communications stack includes encrypted video teleconferencing that can patch in agencies, combatant commands, foreign leaders. The watch floor has feeds from every intelligence agency streaming in real time. It's a nerve center, not a throne room.
So when a reporter says the president has gone to the Situation Room, what they're actually describing is the president walking into a secured basement complex where information is being synthesized, not a dramatic command post where he's about to push a button.
Right. And that's the core tension of the whole facility. The Situation Room doesn't issue orders. It doesn't command anything. The actual military chain of command runs through the Pentagon, through the National Military Command Center, through the combatant commands. The Situation Room's job is to make sure that when the President or the National Security Council needs to understand what's happening, the information is there, it's accurate, and it's integrated across every agency that has a piece of the puzzle.
So it's the brain's thalamus, routing and filtering sensory input, not the motor cortex that moves the arm.
That's actually a really good analogy. On a normal day, the watch floor is continuously monitoring global events. They're producing the president's daily brief, which is the intelligence community's best synthesis of what the president needs to know that morning. There are routine interagency meetings. Deputies from state, defense, the intelligence agencies, they'll meet in one of the conference rooms, hash out coordination on ongoing issues. It's bureaucratic, it's procedural, and most of the time nothing dramatic is happening.
The world's most secure staff meeting.
Essentially. But then you have a crisis day. Something breaks. A terrorist attack, a foreign military move, a natural disaster with geopolitical implications. The watch floor escalates immediately. The watch team is trained to recognize what needs to go up the chain and how fast. Principals get convened. The Secretary of State, Secretary of Defense, National Security Advisor, Chairman of the Joint Chiefs. They gather in the main conference room. Live intelligence feeds start getting piped in. Drone feeds, satellite imagery, signals intercepts. The room becomes the hub for real-time coordination.
And this is where the Bin Laden raid photo comes in, because that's the image that cemented the Situation Room in the public imagination. May 2011, Obama and his national security team watching the operation unfold in real time.
And what's striking about that photo is what it doesn't show. There's no giant glowing map. There's no dramatic countdown. It's a group of people staring intently at screens, listening to audio feeds, their faces tense. The actual orders had already been issued through the military chain of command. The SEAL team was getting direction from Joint Special Operations Command, not from the White House basement. What the people in that room were doing was monitoring, not commanding. They were watching their decision play out.
Which is a very different thing from the Hollywood version, where the president is barking orders at a screen, and the missiles launch because he said so.
And that's the decision support role in a nutshell. The Situation Room synthesizes information, presents options, supports the President and the National Security Council in making decisions. But those decisions are then executed through entirely separate command channels. The room is a node in a network, not the brain itself.
So let's talk about why this particular node became iconic. Because Daniel's right. There are plenty of command centers around the world that nobody's ever heard of. The National Military Command Center at the Pentagon is arguably more important operationally, and it's not a household name.
The Bin Laden photo is a huge part of it. That image humanized the space in a way that no description ever could. You see the President of the United States, the Secretary of State with her hand over her mouth, the tension on every face. It's a photograph of people waiting, and waiting is something everyone understands. It made the Situation Room feel real and accessible, even though it's one of the most secure spaces on Earth.
And then there's the name itself, Situation Room. It sounds like something out of a thriller. It's punchy. It's evocative. The British call theirs COBR, Cabinet Office Briefing Rooms, which sounds like a furniture catalog.
COBR is actually a great comparison point, and Daniel specifically asked about it. It stands for Cabinet Office Briefing Rooms. The acronym is usually pronounced COBRA, and it's located in the Cabinet Office building on Whitehall. It serves a similar purpose as a multi-agency crisis coordination hub, but the structure is different. COBR isn't a permanent 24/7 watch floor. It convenes as needed. It's a committee of ministers and senior officials, chaired by the Prime Minister or a designated senior minister, and it brings together whichever departments are relevant to the crisis at hand.
So it's more of an ad hoc crisis committee with a dedicated facility, rather than a standing operation.
Right. The UK has other permanent monitoring capabilities. The Joint Intelligence Committee, the military's permanent joint headquarters. But COBR itself is a meeting, not a continuous watch. When a crisis hits, the Cabinet Secretary sends out a convening notice, the relevant people assemble, and the room gets activated. It's a different philosophy. The US keeps the engine running at all times. The UK starts the engine when it's needed.
Which probably reflects different threat profiles and different scales. The US has global military operations happening continuously. The UK's operational tempo is lower.
And that difference in philosophy shows up across all the countries Daniel asked about. Israel's setup is fascinating because it's shaped by a fundamentally different reality. Israel's National Security Council operates out of the Prime Minister's office and their war room, sometimes called the Knesset Basement Facility, though that's a bit of a misnomer, is smaller, more agile, designed for rapid military integration. Israel doesn't have the luxury of time. Their crisis tempo is constant. So the system is built for speed, direct feeds from military intelligence, immediate connectivity with the IDF's operations directorate, a much shorter chain between information and action.
They've essentially collapsed the distinction between the information hub and the decision-making venue because they can't afford the latency.
And that's not a design flaw. It's an adaptation to a threat environment where a rocket attack gives you somewhere between 15 seconds and 2 minutes of warning. You can't have a separate watch floor synthesize information, send it up to principals, and then have them deliberate. The synthesis and the decision have to happen almost simultaneously.
What about France?
The Élysée Palace has a crisis center, the Centre Décrise, and it's compact and highly centralized. It sits in the basement of the presidential palace, and it's designed around the French model of executive power, which is very concentrated in the presidency. The room itself is relatively small compared to the US complex, but it's wired for secure communications with French military command, intelligence services, and diplomatic posts. The French approach reflects their nuclear deterrent posture too. The president personally authorizes any nuclear release, so the crisis center includes the communications architecture for that.
And then there's Russia.
Russia's National Defense Control Center is a completely different beast. It's a massive militarized complex in Moscow, opened in 2014, and it combines civilian and military functions under one roof. We're talking a multi-story facility with a giant video wall, tiered seating for operators, and real-time feeds from across the Russian military. It's designed to project power as much as to manage it. The architecture is deliberately imposing. It's meant to look like the nerve center of a superpower. The philosophy is different from the US approach. Where the Situation Room is about quiet, secure information synthesis, the Russian center is about visible, centralized control.
So it's partly functional and partly theatrical.
That's true of all of these facilities to some degree. The Situation Room's name and mystique serve a purpose too. It communicates seriousness, preparedness, the idea that the government has a handle on things. But I think the Russian version leans harder into the theater. The scale of it, the giant screens, the uniformed officers at consoles, it's designed to impress domestic audiences and signal capability to foreign ones.
And China?
China's Central Military Commission operates a joint operations command center that's highly centralized and military dominated. There's less public visibility. China doesn't release photos of the President Xi equivalent of the Bin Laden moment, but the function is similar, information fusion and decision support. The key difference is that in China's system, the military and the party are more tightly integrated, so the command center doesn't have the same interagency character that the US Situation Room has. It's not State Department and CIA and Pentagon all sitting at the same table. It's the military coordinating with the military, reporting up through party channels.
Across all these countries, you see the same basic problem being solved. How do you get accurate, real-time information to the people who make decisions? But the solutions reflect different constitutional structures, different threat environments, and different political cultures.
That's the thing Hollywood never shows you. Films present the Situation Room as a decision theater. The president stands in front of a glowing map. Someone says, "We have a developing situation," and the president makes a dramatic call. In reality, it's a layered bureaucratic process. The watch floor has already been tracking the situation for hours or days before it reaches the principals. The intelligence has been analyzed, cross-referenced, caveated. Options have been staffed through the interagency process. By the time the president walks into that room, the decision is often about choosing between pre-vetted courses of action, not improvising under pressure.
The drama is in the preparation, not the moment.
That's the part that's hard to dramatize, so films don't try. They collapse the whole process into a single scene with a single room and a single decision. It makes for better cinema. It also creates a completely misleading impression of how crisis management actually works.
Let's get into the technical side, because Daniel asked what distinguishes this from an ordinary conference room full of screens. And I think the answer is partly about the security architecture, and partly about the information architecture.
The security architecture is the foundation. A CIF isn't just a room with a locked door. It's a facility where every surface, every cable, every ventilation duct has been inspected and certified to block electronic emissions that could be intercepted. The communications are encrypted end-to-end. The video teleconferencing runs over dedicated secure networks, not the public internet. There are no wireless devices. The watch floor has what's called a sensitive compartmented information handling system. Different agencies can feed in intelligence at different classification levels, and the system manages who can see what based on their clearances and need to know.
You could have a CIA analyst looking at human intelligence, an NSA analyst looking at signals intercepts, and a DIA analyst looking at satellite imagery, all in the same room, but each only seeing what they're cleared to see.
The synthesis happens at the watch commander level, where someone with the right clearances can see across all of it and piece together the picture. That's the information architecture piece. It's not just about having screens. It's about having a system that can take multiple intelligence streams, human, SIGINT, GOINT, OSINT, and fuse them into a coherent operational picture in something close to real time.
That's the part that's hard. The technology exists. The organizational challenge is getting agencies that don't naturally share to actually share.
That's been the struggle since the place was created. The Situation Room was established by Kennedy after the Bay of Pigs, precisely because the intelligence failure there was partly an information-sharing failure. Different agencies had pieces of the picture, and nobody put them together in time. The Situation Room was designed to fix that, to be the place where the pieces come together. And it's been an ongoing challenge ever since, because agencies protect their turf, their sources, their methods.
The room is as much an organizational solution as a technological one.
That's the practical lesson for anyone thinking about crisis management, whether you're running a business or a government. The screens and the secure comms are the easy part. The hard part is designing protocols that make sure the right information reaches the right people at the right time, and that nobody's sitting on a crucial piece of the puzzle because it came through their channel and they don't want to share.
Daniel's prompt has a practical dimension here, whether he meant it or not. He's essentially asking, what can we learn from how professionals do this? And I think the answer is, separate information gathering from decision-making.
That's the watch floor mindset. Have a team whose only job is to monitor, synthesize, and escalate. They're not making decisions. They're not even recommending decisions. They're building the picture. Then have a separate process for deliberation and decision. When you collapse those two functions, when the same person is trying to gather information and make decisions simultaneously, you get tunnel vision. You fixate on the first plausible explanation and stop looking for contradictory evidence.
The Situation Room's physical layout enforces this. The watch floor is separate from the conference rooms. The people doing the monitoring aren't the people doing the deliberating. There's a handoff.
The handoff is structured. It's not just someone running into the conference room and saying, you won't believe what just happened. It's a formatted briefing with sourcing, confidence levels, and explicit identification of what's known versus what's assumed. The military calls this facts and assumptions. You separate them rigorously, because confusing an assumption for a fact is how you get Bay of Pigs.
If you're designing your own situation room for a business or a team, the actionable advice is, focus on communication protocols and role definitions, not just screens and dashboards. Know who's monitoring, who's deciding, and how the handoff works.
Practice it. The Situation Room runs exercises. They simulate crises. They stress test the comms. Because when something real happens, you don't want to be discovering that the video feed from CENTCOM doesn't work or that the secure phone in Breakout Room 3 has a dead battery.
The boring stuff matters.
The boring stuff is most of what matters. The Bin Laden raid was a dramatic moment, but the reason it worked was years of unglamorous preparation. The intelligence analysis, the interagency coordination, the rehearsal of the raid itself, the communications architecture that let the president watch it unfold. None of that makes for a good movie scene, but it's the whole game.
Let's talk about what films get wrong, because Daniel asked directly, and I think the answer breaks down into a few categories.
The first is the physical space. Movies show a single dramatic room with a giant screen and ambient blue lighting. Reality is a suite of beige conference rooms with secure phones and standard-issue government furniture. The Bin Laden photo is actually a great reference here. Look at it closely and it's just a conference room. Wood table, office chairs, some screens on the wall. Nothing looks like a spaceship.
The second is the decision process. Films show the president making a snap call based on a 30-second briefing. Reality is a multi-hour or multi-day process with legal reviews, diplomatic coordination, military feasibility assessments. The decision has usually been shaped long before the president enters the room.
The third is the information itself. Films show a single, unambiguous threat, a blinking dot on a map, a countdown clock. Real intelligence is fragmentary, contradictory, and full of caveats. The watch floor is dealing with multiple sources that disagree with each other. The synthesis is an act of judgment, not just reading a screen.
The fourth is the chain of command. Films show the president issuing orders directly to units in the field. In reality, the president communicates intent to the Secretary of Defense, who communicates it through the military chain of command. The Situation Room isn't patched into the tactical network. That's by design. It prevents political leaders from micromanaging military operations.
There's a famous example of this from the Bin Laden raid. Obama wasn't giving real-time direction to the SEALs. He was watching the same feeds they were getting at the Pentagon and at JSOC headquarters. The tactical decisions. how to handle the downed helicopter, how to clear the compound, were made by the commanders in the chain, not by the people in the Situation Room.
Which circles back to the core insight here. The Situation Room's power is in its information architecture. Secure, real-time, multi-source synthesis. Not in any single technology or room. It's a system, not a place.
That system is going to face some interesting challenges going forward. The threat landscape is shifting. Cyber warfare doesn't announce itself with satellite imagery of troop movements. Disinformation campaigns don't show up on drone feeds. The kind of intelligence that the Situation Room was designed to synthesize, traditional military and diplomatic intelligence, may not be the kind that matters most in the next crisis.
The question becomes whether the information hub model adapts to threats that are less visible and more ambiguous.
Right. If a hostile actor takes down part of the electrical grid through a cyber attack, the indicators are going to come from DHS and the energy sector, not from the CIA's human intelligence network. If a disinformation campaign is shaping public opinion ahead of an election, the relevant data is coming from social media monitoring, not from signals intercepts. The Situation Room's architecture was built for a world of state-on-state conflict with clear physical indicators. It's not obvious that the same architecture works for the world we're moving into.
Although the principle, get all the relevant information into one room, synthesize it, present it to decision makers, that principle is threat agnostic. The challenge is expanding the definition of relevant information and bringing in agencies that haven't traditionally been part of the national security apparatus.
That's an organizational challenge more than a technical one. The secure comms exist. The question is whether the FBI, CISA, the Treasury Department's Financial Intelligence Unit, whether they're integrated into the Watch Force picture in the same way the CIA and DIA are. Historically, the answer has been, not really. The Situation Room was designed by and for the traditional national security community.
Maybe the next evolution is less about better screens and more about broader participation.
I think that's right. And some of that's already happening. The Cyber Threat Integration Center, the Election Security Coordination, those are attempts to broaden the aperture. But institutional culture changes slowly, especially in classified environments where trust is built over years.
If the Situation Room is mostly an information hub and not where decisions get made, why does the president actually go there during a crisis instead of just getting briefed in the Oval Office?
That's a sharp question. Part of it's practical. The secure communications in the Situation Room are better than what's available in the Oval Office. You can patch in multiple agencies and foreign leaders simultaneously in a way you can't from the residence or the West Wing offices.
Part of it's symbolic. Going to the Situation Room signals seriousness. It tells the national security team that this isn't a routine matter. It tells the public, when the press reports it, that the government is treating the crisis with the gravity it deserves. There's a performative dimension to it, and that's not a criticism. Signaling is a real function of leadership.
Thanks, Hilbert. So where does all this leave us? I think the big takeaway is that the Situation Room's real power is organizational, not technological. It's the place where the U.S. government has decided that information will be shared across agency boundaries, in real time, under one roof. That sounds obvious, and it's incredibly hard to do in practice.
The practical lesson for anyone listening is that in any crisis, the most important thing you can build isn't a fancy dashboard. It's a clear protocol for who knows what, who needs to know it, and how it gets from one to the other. Everything else is decoration.
The open question I keep coming back to is whether the model holds as the threat landscape shifts. When the next major crisis isn't a military move that shows up on satellite imagery, but something slower and more diffuse, a cyber campaign, a biological event, a financial attack. Does the Situation Room's architecture still work? Or do we need something that looks more like a continuous analytical process than a room you go to when things get hot?
I suspect the answer is that the room becomes less important and the network becomes more important. The watch floor concept, continuous monitoring, multi-source synthesis, that's durable. But the idea of principals gathering in a single secured space may give way to something more distributed, especially as secure communications improve. You might not need to be in the same room to have the same conversation.
Something to watch. Thanks to our producer, Hilbert Flumingtop, for the question, and thanks to Daniel for a prompt that sent us down an interesting rabbit hole.
This has been My Weird Prompts. You can find us at myweirdprompts.com, and if you've got a question you want us to dig into, email the show at show@myweirdprompts.com. We'll be back soon.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth's slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.